Welcome to this Catholic Theological Union podcast featuring a lecture by Dr. Elia Delio, OSF, titled Evolution and the Primacy of Christ, from SCOTUS to Teilhard. Dr. Delio is introduced by Father Edward Foley, Capuchin, the current holder of the Duns Scotus Chair in Spirituality. Father Foley is Professor of Liturgy and Music at CTU. This talk was recorded at CTU on Tuesday, October 6, 2015, for the annual Duns Scotus Lecture.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Foley. I have the privilege of being the current holder of the Duns Scotus Chair in Spirituality. The first holder of the Chair in Spirituality was the Bonaventurian scholar and great friend, Zachary Hayes, who is now in the eternal dialogue with Bonaventure. The second chair holder is Emerita Professor Diane Brigant, who is not only with us, but I think she's with us. So, Diane, thank you for being here. The Duns Scotus Chair was established in 1997 by a gracious gift from the Cincinnati province of the Order of Friars Minor. Their provincial, Father Jeff, is sorry that he could not be here, but there are other brothers from that province who are here. So would the friars representing the province please stand so we can thank you for this? Thank you, thank you. Dr. Elia Delio, as the Germans would like to say, is a Franciscan sister of Washington, D.C., an American theologian specializing in the areas of science and religion. She graduated with a B.S. in biology from DeSales University in Center Valley, Pennsylvania, subsequently pursued a master's degree in biology at Seton Hall, followed by a doctorate in pharmacology from Rutgers University. She was subsequently offered a postdoc fellow at John Hopkins University in the Alzheimer's research, which she relinquished to enter a Carmelite monastery. She left the monastery and joined a Franciscan community. And when she did so, she did a postdoc in neurotoxicology at Rutgers University, where she became a research fellow. While in formation with her Franciscan community, she was asked to study theology and matriculated at Fordham, where she obtained a master's degree in theology and a doctorate in historical theology with a dissertation entitled Mysticism of the Historical Event, an Approach Through Bonaventure's Christ Mysticism. Following graduation from Fordham, she taught in science and religion at Trinity College. For 12 years, she was professor and chair of spirituality departments at Washington Theological Union. She became a senior research fellow at Woodstock Theological Center. And in 2003, she became director of Catholic Studies and visiting professor at Georgetown. She is also a neuroethics fellow at the Pellegrino Center for Clinical Bioethics at Georgetown Medical School. Most recently, quite recently, she has been named to the Josephine Connolly Endowed Chair in Theology at Villanova University. Unless she wrote one on the plane, reliable sources indicate that she's the author of 15 books, including Care for Creation. Her new books include The Unbearable Wholeness of Being and From Teilhard to Omega. We could expend other energies detailing her many accomplishments, but to do so would keep us in the secondary sources and deprive us of encountering the primary source that we've gathered to hear. So without delay, speaking on the topic Evolution and the Primacy of Christ from SCOTUS to Teilhard, it is my great honor to invite you to welcome our sister in Claire and Francis, Elia Delio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It is just wonderful to be back here at CTU after a number of years. The last time I was here, I was locked out of Heartbreak Hotel, so I'm really happy to see this beautiful new building and the light-filledness of this building. And also to hear my resume. My God, I get weary, you know. My topic for this afternoon is on evolution and the primacy of Christ, but that's really to lure you here to my to my vision of science and religion. You know, I guess in a school of theology, a typical theological lecture would begin, certainly a lecture on Christ, might begin with scripture. But quite honestly, I think what has fallen out of our theological worldview today is the essential role, the fundamental role of cosmology. We know that any theology that we study is always based on a particular cosmology. And I think Raymond Panikkar in his book, The Rhythm of Being, said it best when he said, there is no cosmos without God. By cosmos, we mean that whole order of things. And there's no God without cosmos. And so, you know, from the ancients on, we do see this integral relationship between cosmology and theology. And so I want to structure my talk today really based on cosmology. And then from there, we'll talk about theology and the theology of Jesus Christ. Our theology was really constructed in an age of consciousness that many people today refer to as the first axial period, or that period loosely between 800 and 200 BCE, where there was sort of a breakthrough in consciousness in all the major parts of the world. By breakthrough, we mean that we shifted from a tribal, mythic, ritualist, communal type of consciousness that we would associate today with preaxial or primal spiritualities to a type of consciousness marked by autonomy, freedom, and the sense of the individual. That consciousness came with it a type, an understanding of cosmos that we can attribute to the Greeks. I think it's really Ptolemy in the second century who is sort of the father of the ancient cosmos in this sense. Now, here's just a rough sketch of it in your left-hand corner. And as you can see, this cosmos, this Greek cosmos, is perfectly ordered. I think the Greeks like circles. And they had this perfectly ordered cosmos that was immutable, unchangeable. And for us, the important thing is it's geocentric. In other words, it's earth-centered. And the center of the earth is, of course, the human person. And so as that cosmos entered into Christian thinking, our Christian scholars such as Bonaventure and Scotus and Thomas Aquinas would come to understand this cosmos. I mean, if you went to the University of Paris in the 13th century, you did study astronomy and physics and geometry, as well as scripture and theology. And so when they thought about God, and when they thought about salvation, they thought of those truths of faith in light of this cosmos. Now, one thing about the Middle Ages that still, I think, is beginning to resonate again with us is that for the Christians, this cosmos reflected God. In other words, one could find the footprints in God in nature, as they could find, you might say, that God in Scripture. So nature was referred to as a book, as Scripture was a book. So the two books being nature and Scripture. But of course, medieval art, I think, you know, gave us the image of God as the creator who ordained this lovely, immutable, perfectly circular, geocentric, anthropocentric cosmos. And, you know, I think even to our own time, you know, there is sometimes this understanding that God knows where everything is, you know, because God is the, you know, the big geometer. But here to the right is another kind of medieval sketch, you know, of a geocentric cosmos with the little human face there in the center. And of course, in this story, and here's why cosmology is really important to us, because it shapes our story, our narrative, right? And we are storytellers. And the stories we tell imparts or shapes the meaning of our lives. And so we have a story that is based on this static, lovely, fixed, anthropocentric cosmos. And the storyline is one we all know. God created, as we blended cosmos with Genesis, God created a Garden of Eden and placed there some trees and, of course, two people. And one of them, of course, you know, didn't hear too well and lured the other one into a sinful state, and there was a need for redemption. I mean, that's just a very, very broad sketch. To say there was an original goodness, there was a defect in creation, and there was a need for redemption. And then medieval art built on that, that Jesus Christ came to redeem us from our sins, an atonement theology that focused largely on sin and redemption. And of course, in the later periods, we have the notion of Christ as the just judge. So that, you know, in the Catholic milieu, and as well, I think we can say later, in the Protestant milieu, the emphasis was on death, sin, death, judgment. And of course, if you didn't all get it right, you were going to hell, right? You know, down where the lower realms of life did not happen. And of course, here we have Saint Michael spearing off all those deadly bodies. This type of thinking, according to some, now here's a blending of things. We are saying that a cosmology inherited from the Greeks, along with the Greek philosophical notion of true reality lies in a world beyond, or that strain of philosophy we call Neoplatonism, that, you know, that there's an ultimate good and the real good things are above. Here we live in a world of okay things that are passing away. And so architecture began to take its cue even from this kind of Neoplatonic spirituality. Gothic architecture in particular, you know, you walk into a Gothic cathedral like the Washington Cathedral, that snapshot on top, and you are immediately drawn upward by the very high ceilings. And this idea was that light pours in from above and lifts us up from the earth to contemplate the things of the divine. And so this lifting up from earth to heaven became, in a sense, expressed in art, in our thinking, in our prayers, because we were here in a static fixed center, and our Christian thought was to go to heaven. And many people still talk like this. They think like this. We think religiously with a three-tiered cosmology. But here is, in a sense, part of our challenge. And I'd like to say this. I think what we are experiencing today with regard to ecology, with regard to human personhood, has its roots in the 16th century. In other words, I don't think our problems are really modern problems. I think they are a few centuries in the making. And this may be one of the most radical challenges to Christianity and to understanding the meaning of Christ in our lives. And that is the rise of heliocentrism. This was first, one of the famous names associated with heliocentrism is Nicholas Copernicus, that wonderful Polish astronomer who began to observe things and record things in detail and said, oh my God, it was an OMG for Nick. He said, you know, I don't think this is a sun-centered cosmos. Rather, this is an earth-centered cosmos. Rather, it seems to be sun-centered, heliocentric. His findings were substantiated by Johannes Kepler, Tycho Brahe, and others to say that indeed the Earth is moving around the sun along with the other planets. That did not go well because we had created an understanding of theology based on the Ptolemaic cosmos. Now, Galileo Galilei had a more powerful telescope. He confirmed the findings of Copernicus and said the old system is not wrong. It is rather that the new system is more accurate to the world we actually live in. So, you know, he said, along with Cardinal Baronius, the Bible tells us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. The Bible is not a science book. But we know it did not go well for Galileo, and he had no email or Twitter account. So we have only his great book. We know, sketching this out, that a world of change was a world of challenge. And one of those challenges came in the form of knowledge. How can we know God with any certainty if this earth is moving? And so Descartes basically stripped the natural world of any sacred meaning and put that knowledge of God in the self-thinking subject. I think, therefore I am, therefore there must be absolute being itself, right? And from Descartes, Sir Isaac Newton develops then a world of order based on inert matter. In other words, stuff is stripped of any sacred meaning, of any divinity. It is simply physical inert substance that is lawfully connected. Now, I think for all practical purposes, we are children of Newton with medieval religious frameworks. And Newton's world could be, in a sense, described, this is a sketch by M.C. Escher, where each block has its autonomous location, but it's connected to every other block by some sort of relation. In a sense, that's how the modern person has come to see oneself as, you know, an autonomous individual who is somehow related to other individuals. And of course, Newton's world is a world of lawfulness and orderliness. So even, you know, the maxim that we had from religious life, keep the rule, and the rule will keep you. Do not sit in the superior's place, either in the refectory or in the chapel. You will not have a vocation if you do that, right? You will have upset all cosmic order. But as my colleague Jack Haught has said, a religion built on stability and immutability is not prepared for a cosmic order based on change. And I do think it's really important to just be somewhat aware of the cosmos we actually live in before we talk about the person of Jesus Christ. So here's just three sketches of three levels of the new science. The large, which is the Big Bang model, the small, or the level of quantum reality, and the complex, which is the area of evolution. Newton's world, in other words, our understanding of a world of stuff that is lawfully organized in absolute space and absolute time, was overturned in the early 20th century by that wonderful mathematician who worked in a little Swiss patent office by the name of Albert Einstein. And basically, Einstein had a great imagination, and he just imagined what it would be like to ride at the speed of light on a beam of light. And he began to realize, mathematically, of course, that there is no such thing as absolute space and absolute time, even though religiously we still think in these categories. But rather, time is really, in a sense, what you measure wherever you find yourself. So it's not space and time, it is really space-time. And space-time is a dimension now that we know of our universe. This space-time can be stretched and it can shrink depending on the mass or the heaviness of the objects within it. This is our cosmos, a very brief sketch of our cosmos, as science can at least talk about it today. It is neither stable, fixed, nor geocentric. It is rather a very, very old cosmos, about 13.8 billion years old. Now, if you're feeling old, just think of the age of the cosmos. It's really a very sobering thing. First of all, we don't know how this cosmos began. I leave that to cosmologists, and astronomers. That's the realm of science. There are all sorts of speculations. Basically, the mathematics breaks down at the point called the singularity. It could be out of a black hole of a previous cosmos. We could be one of many universes, what they call the multiverse theory. All we know that it began as a hot, dense something, sort of what they call quantum foam or quantum fluctuations, and it rapidly expanded from its hot density. And the forces that, you know, allow us to sit here and to keep ourselves upright were in place within the first 3 minutes of this cosmos. This, our universe, takes long, long periods of time for things to happen. About a billion years for galaxies and stars and planets to form. This universe will continue on for about maybe 9 billion years, if the sun doesn't burn out, maybe 100 trillion years. All I know is probably you and I will not be here to see the end of this story. It is an expanding universe. On the large level of the cosmos, it is expanding, and we ourselves may feel ourselves expanding with the cosmos at times, and that's how we can talk of ourselves as cosmic children. Our own Earth is about 4.6 million, billion years old. We are relative newcomers in this universe. We're not old. We're new, and we probably emerge out of a supernova or the gas and dust that might have emerged from an exploding star. When we look at the fundamental levels of life, we see that really we are a world of energy. We hear more and more about energy today, but we are saying, and this comes from Einstein, that energy is not something different from mass, as if mass and energy might be two different things that somehow get glued together. In the same way that we still talk about body and soul that somehow get glued together, or matter and spirit, what Einstein realized is that energy and matter are interconvertible. That one can be converted to the other without losing its essential content. This energy reality took on new dimensions when in the early 20th century, I love scientists, by the way, because they always dream up these really crazy experiments, you know, and one of them was to shoot a beam of electron through two slits in a wall. Now, like, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? You know, put two slits in your wall. And when they did that, you know, in a Newtonian world, in an objective world, you would expect two slits on the other side, right? One beam of electron, two slits on the other side. And what they found was this strange wave-particle interference pattern. And they realized that one had to measure, you know, the results to determine what the actual outcome was. So quantum reality holds out for us now a new way of understanding ourselves as participating in what the real is. That we live, in a sense, in this complicated webs of relationship on the most fundamental levels of life, where everything is, in a sense, connected with everything else. But we, in a sense, are the observers. So the role of consciousness comes to a new level of importance in the naming of the real. Albert Einstein, you know, had difficulties with quantum physics, with the idea that there could be uncertainty in nature, you know, real uncertainty. And he also didn't think that things could be impacted one another at long distances. But he had two postdocs, and really that's why I'm going to a doctoral program now, because postdocs, you know, they come up with questions you wouldn't even think of asking, right? And Einstein's postdoc said this: well, what if we took, you know, two particles that interacted, and what if we split them apart? And we put half the particle here on the podium at CTU in Chicago, and the other half on the moon. What would happen if we changed this particle, turned it, you know, 180 degrees up? They speculated the particle on the moon would turn 180 degrees down. And they call this quantum entanglement, or spooky action at a distance. It's spooky. Now, what could this mean on a human level? Well, I always give the example of, do you ever think of someone you interacted, you worked with someone, you know, here at CTU for many years, or you knew them as a classmate, and you separate, right? You stay here in Chicago, the person goes off to Northern Alaska, and you haven't heard from them for, you know, a long time. And out of the blue, you get a phone call, you know, and you go, I can't believe it, I was just thinking about you. And now you can say, we are quantumly entangled. So it does matter who you really interact with, because you are interacted forever. So what we are saying is that nature is not composed of material substances, but rather it's composed of deeply entangled fields of energy. Why I say this, and why this is important for us, because when we talk about the person of Jesus Christ, I mean, we use language. You know, we've gotten so accustomed to the language of natures. Oh, yeah, divine nature, human nature. You know, one in being with the Father, one in being with us. What are we talking about? Because science is telling us that nature is deeply entangled fields of energy. And what we are realizing today is these entangled fields of energy on a fundamental level form an undivided whole. Paul Dirac, a physicist in the early 20th century, said this: we are so deeply connected across energy fields that if you pick a flower, you will move the farthest star. In other words, there is no such thing as an isolated action. There is no such thing as no one knows what I'm thinking or what I'm doing. We really, in a sense, all know, because both your thoughts and your actions have global effects, far-reaching effects. And that, to our mind, strikes us like, huh? Well, welcome to the 20th century. That's all we're saying. Because what we are, what I am maybe holding up here is that we are in between paradigms. I think a lot of our religious thinking is, in a sense, still bearing the trappings of the Middle Ages. Culturally, we are Newtonians or quasi-Newtonians. And we are still now coming to grips with a very new world as science discloses it to us. So we are moving from what we call closed systems, or those systems that are bounded, that in a sense have very little exchange with the environment, to systems that are open, systems that are, you might say, working in tandem with the environment and can be affected by the environment. If I were to transpose this idea of closed system to open system, if I were to read the life of Jesus in light of systems, I think Jesus of Nazareth was something of an open system in a closed system milieu. In other words, Jesus comes in and he's open to the environment. He is what we call, from chaos theory, sort of like a strange attractor, a basin of attraction that, you know, jars, right, his fellow Jews. And they say, what is this guy up to? But he starts pulling that order into a new order that we now call Christian. The physicist David Bohm said, we are so deeply interconnected and entangled in an undivided wholeness that as human beings and societies, we seem separate. but in our roots we're part of an indivisible whole and share in the same cosmic process. We hear today global consciousness. We experience it more and more because our fastest evolver today is technology. In other words, it is linking us in a way unprecedented. So it does bring us then to the level of evolution. If we find ourselves in an expanding universe that is deeply connected on a fundamental level, we also know ourselves to be open to greater levels of complexity and consciousness. Evolution is one of those words that still causes cultural divides, but I'm using it in a descriptive way, beyond Darwin, as to talk about the fact that life proceeds from simple to complex, that it proceeds by way of lawfulness and chance or spontaneity, that life is not so much mechanistic but process. Now, without going through, because I know I see you're all bibliophiles, you know, you love books, that's why you're here. But think of our own life in this evolutionary story as being part of a book. That, you know, if we were in this encyclopedia of life that had 30 volumes, each volume with 450 pages, and each page a million years. Volume 1 would be the Big Bang, volume 21, the Earth, and then volume 30, that would be our volume, by the way, you know, the dinosaurs go extinct, page 385, the mammals appear, and there we are, the last volume, the last page, page 450, the last line, and the last two words of that line are human beings. We are in evolution. There is no period after this, after beings, period. We are now in a story of unfolding complexity. Now, I am following here the framework of the Jesuit scientist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. He was a scientist. He was not a trained theologian, although they did send him for theology, like good Jesuits. But as a scientist, his Ignatian spirituality, his Jesuit mind, impacted the way he understood evolution. And therefore, he saw evolution descriptively as a process of convergence that over these vast amount of times, things keep being drawn together, like as if there's a fundamental law of attraction in the universe. And as things come together, they form new degrees of relationships, complexity. And as they form these new relationships, there's a rise in consciousness. And so he says that evolution, in a sense, is this continuous process of convergence, complexity, and consciousness, and we're, in a sense, right now, sort of the voice of this whole immense process. So that we're not just in evolution, or like people say, do you believe in evolution? It's not a belief system. It is simply the best explanation for the way life unfolds. So we are not in it, we are it. In other words, well, here's just to show that we are evolving, in case you weren't sure. Because, you know, the funny thing is, technology, now I just want to put this out there. Technology is our fastest evolver, right? It's converging us. Whoever heard of world religions back in 1960, I'm sure they were around. I'm only kidding. I remember when the first cell phone came out, it was like this big. You know, and if someone said to me, you will one day hold a computer in your hand, in the palm of your hand, I would have said, you're out of your mind, right? Well, we're out of our minds. We now hold them in the palm of our hand, right? And we continue to evolve with technology. Only it's not happening at the same rate. Half the species is evolving at a faster clip, but that's why it's a long, long process, and we'll catch up. Here we are, and I want to situate us in the cosmos we actually live in. Okay? We are here sort of at the apex, the growing tip of this evolutionary process. We emerge out of this process, but we can now reflect on it. And that is, in a sense, you know, the tremendous mystery of self-reflective consciousness. So Teilhard described evolution as the rise of consciousness, that as life unfolds towards greater complexity, consciousness rising, it arises in us now in a self-reflective way. And that means how we are conscious of our lives and the choices we make out of that consciousness impacts the future direction of evolution itself. And here's what technology will say. Religion is behind, it's way behind. It's still in the past ages. And the maxim of transhumanism, if you're familiar with that movement of technology to move us to the next stage of humanity, their maxim is technology will fulfill what religion promises. Because we're still trying to, in some way, sometimes, get out of the 16th century. But what we do know today is that more and more is that consciousness is not contra Descartes, not something other than matter. Consciousness, in a sense, arises within the material universe itself. And therefore, what accounts for the human mind is active in the universe. It is not mind over matter, it is mindful matter. And therefore, in light of this brief sketch of things, Teilhard, I love this picture of Teilhard because his eyes seem to be looking in a new direction, as if he sees something that we long to see. He said at one point, who will give evolution its own God? Well, I read that and I said, well, I'll give it a try since, you know, we haven't really, you know, come up with anything yet. So I wrote a few books, but it hasn't gone very far. In other words, we need to really think theology in light of this cosmos that we now find ourselves. Now, we know that theology lives and breathes on philosophy. And therefore, it's not just that our theology has to change, our philosophy needs to find a new understanding that is consonant with the world in which we actually live. Teilhard began to look in this direction, and he began to realize that it is a world of energy, and it's a world of increasing unity. And he said that love, or love energy, is, you might say, that fundamental force of all cosmic life. Now, this, I think, this idea is very consonant with what the medievalists would have held or thought about love, that deepest good that seeks to share itself with another in a transforming way. In modern culture, we have reduced love, right, to sort of a sentiment or emotion. But what Teilhard said is that the physical structure of the universe is love. In other words, it's not just we're little atoms, you know, who, by the way, have the capacity to love. Love, he says, is the starting point, which means union precedes being itself. That relationality is, in a sense, the ontology of all life. And therefore, he looked and he said, but there is, in a sense, a principle of centration or something that continues to hold life together as it moves towards greater levels of complexity. And he called this principle omega. At first, it's a principle of absolute centration. In other words, things don't, over time, they don't dissipate or fly apart. They seem to, at least on the biological level, they seem to coalesce. And then he links this omega with God. But this is very scriptural, right? I am the Alpha and the Omega. And so what Teilhard is saying is that God, the future, is already present in the now. The future is already, in a sense, in our present life. So this God Omega, he says, is from the beginning. God Omega present in the Big Bang, and therefore empowering evolution towards more being and life. So he is a process thinker. In other words, he doesn't, although at times he uses a language of primary and secondary causality. I think he uses that once or twice, but he does see rather this, I would call it an organic relationship between God and the world. He says the world is continuously participating in God, and God is continuously empowering the world. So that there is, in a sense, no God without cosmos and no cosmos without God. Now, Teilhard, one thing he did not do too much is talk about Trinity. But he does have a Trinitarian thought in his essays on the meaning of Christ in evolution. Here, just as briefly sketching Trinity, you know, a quasi-Cappadocian type of Trinity, you know, which Scotus would have held to a Trinitarian theology that was deeply communal, love-based Trinity. That is therefore, you know, God is therefore relational and self-communicative, and in that self-communicative love, attractive of all life and imparting of life. But I also want to put out there that, again, I find Trinity, we're too smooth about it, quite honestly. We're too glib, as if we really know what we're talking about. You know, yeah, Trinity, yeah, three persons in one, communion, relationship, you know, we got the whole nine yards. I want to step back from that, assumptions that we know what we're talking about when we talk Trinity, and speak about, rather, a fundamental, what Panikkal calls a triadic structure of reality. That reality itself has a principle of maximum unity, and in this maximum unity, there's maximum differentiation, and in these two principles, there's a third movement of creative expression. And that's, in a sense, an understanding, whether we call it Father, Son, Spirit, or creative, you know, God, Son, whatever. In other words, there's a source, a maximum unity that is self-giving, a maximum differentiation of individuation, and out of that relationship, a creative synthesis toward new life. In that respect, I think this is very, very appropriate to Teilhard's thought as well. God, the name God, as that trinitization, or that trinity of, you might say, empowering love, is not just a first cause, you know, an absolute transcendent first cause who is sort of waiting until we all get it right and you know, luring us back. That God, the name God, points to that absolute love always on the horizon of new life. So Eckhart says God is the newest thing there is, the youngest thing, new and young, where oftentimes we make God old and past. And Eckhart says if we are united to God, we become new again. Which then does lead us into the question, if this is not a static, fixed, geocentric universe, then what is the meaning of Jesus, who the early church gave the title of the Christ? What is the meaning of Jesus Christ in a universe that is still coming to be? And I think we need to grapple with this person and this mystery of Christ in an unfinished universe. Teilhard thought that our Christology is too old. He said we have had the same basic storyline, so to speak, for the last number of centuries. And he says what a new humanism that looks to the future must have is nothing less than a more profound Christianity rethought to fit the new dimensions of the world. I want to say this here. Teilhard did not see Christianity as normative of religion. He saw Christianity as normative of evolution. And I want to make underline that distinction because he's often misinterpreted there. In the past, we asked, what is the meaning of Christ in a world upset by perfect sin? Now we must ask, what is the meaning of Christ in an evolving world that is seeking its future? And that is our question. Now, I think I'm preaching to the choirs. You are all graduate students. I know you have been through the higher levels, you know, in Dante's circle. You're on the upper echelons, upper scales of the Paradiso. So I don't need to preach too much here. But, you know, this has been our storyline, right? Original sin is very anthropocentric because it really centers on the human person who was given, you know, a task and didn't get it right. But I often say original sin hasn't done much for us other than make us very, very self-conscious about our sinfulness. On the other hand, you know, we can trace a tradition from Irenaeus of Lyon through Rupert of Deutz, through Duns Scotus, into Karl Rahner, that we called the primacy of Christ. And of course, now having given the Scotus lecture, I should name explicitly that it's Duns Scotus who gave that explicit formulation. That God is love. It's a very theological reason for the incarnation. God is love. And from all eternity, God willed to share that love with the creature, whether or not sin ever entered in. So Christ would have come, whether or not there was ever sin in this universe. Now, I want to say, you know, we still have sin. I mean, Scotus didn't get rid of it, neither did Teilhard. It just may not be as original as we thought it was. Original love. What kind of church or what kind of consciousness could be formed if we, in a sense, moved our, you know, theological telescopes toward original love and Christ as first in God's intention to love and therefore God's intention to create. You know, Teilhard discovered Scotus late in life, only a few years before his death, through Father Allegra, a Franciscan from Sicily. Yay, Sicily. And I always thought, and that was his words, when he discovered Scotus's primacy of Christ, he said, there it is. There is the theology of the future. Now, I always say, had he discovered Scotus earlier, he would have been Teilhard OFM, not Teilhard SJ. And we would have published his works. But no, I'm only... It's okay, Father Jonathan, don't worry about that. Teilhard's thought is very consonant with Franciscan Christology. And I would read Bonaventure, although I see Bonaventure, it, you know, sort of straddling two worlds sometimes. I think his own thought shifts in his later writings. But I think we can say, and hear of happy memory of Father Zach Hayes, you know, that the incarnation is not an afterthought, but this is the intention of creation itself from the Big Bang onward. So Scotus did reject the idea that God first created a world that had no relation to Christ and then afterwards decided to decree, you know, the incarnation. Or as my friend Bill Short would say, why build the Taj Mahal to cover a pothole? You know, why would God do something so great like make this creation, then have a defect happen and then have to fix up, you know, the hole? So what Scotus is saying, nope, Christ is first, the perfect response to God's love. Christ predestined to grace and glory before sin. This whole creation is made for Christ. Christ is the blueprint, in a sense, the motif. But I think, and this may come up for discussion, how we understand the Christ will be really crucial to how we go forth in this tradition in an evolutionary world. So what Franciscans would say is, because of this integral relationship between creation and incarnation, the whole Big Bang cosmos is structured Christologically. And of course, that's a real challenge to scientific materialists who would say this big Big Bang cosmos has no meaning whatsoever. It is simply, just simply energy fields or molecules. But we are saying, both Scotus and then Teilhard, is that creation and incarnation are, in a sense, two movements of the one act of God's self-giving love. Karl Rahner also held this position. And why this is important? Well, I always say we have split these things up: incarnation, creation, redemption. That's so you can get a 4-year degree, right? You can do one course this way, semester, one course this semester. It's really very simple. God is much more simple. We've made God very complex. What Teilhard is saying is God could not appear as the prime evolver or the prime mover without becoming incarnate and without redeeming. In other words, God creates by sharing God's life. God enters into that which creates. As God enters into omega-centered evolution, you might say, things are pulled together, redeemed. Things are unified. So Teilhard sees, he steps back, and he sees something going on within this long process of evolution that, from his religious perspective, is creation, incarnation, redemption as a single movement of God's life, active and alive in this universe. So he calls this Christogenesis. He is saying it's not just about Christ, as if the Christ is a given, but it's the birthing of the Christ. And here I'm talking about Jesus Christ, not to split those realities. But he is saying that something's happening in this evolution, where it's not just something, but he says someone is in evolution. So Teilhard looks at this long process, and he's saying, as we go through evolution, consciousness is rising. There's getting more personal in nature. It's getting more unified. He then begins to talk of a third nature of Christ. And here I think Teilhard goes beyond Chalcedon. It's not just divine human, he's saying, but rather it's divine human organic, that God is deeply immersed and involved, immersed and involved with the evolved. So Christ, he says, is related organically and not simply juridically. Again, I think we have been too juridical about the person of Jesus Christ and have not, had a type of cosmic Christology that includes both the natural world and, you might say, the whole of every people or person. So for both Scotus and Teilhard, we're saying the whole of creation is made for Christ, and Christ is the reason for this world, the reason for the season, so that when we come to Jesus, when we come to Jesus, he's just not like a blip on the screen, like, oh, wow, here we are, But in other words, those principles that have evolved life towards greater relationality, greater wholeness, greater consciousness, those principles now are active and alive in this person, Jesus of Nazareth. He, in a sense, is emerging out of this long evolutionary process. But with Jesus, there is a breakthrough in consciousness. He has a radically new consciousness of God's imminence. Everyone's like, the Jews are awaiting the Messiah. Jesus is, no, something new is at hand. So he is faith in God and yet a liberation of the person to accept our freedom and responsibility in this creation. So again, putting this back, Jesus, the Jew, has this consciousness of materiality, of creation, of personhood and community. I think Jesus is something like a new Big Bang. I mean, we can talk about Jesus, you know, as a new centration. But here's where I find the Christian mindset is still old. You know, we're still, Jesus has come to save us from sin. Rather than Jesus brings a new consciousness of creativity and newness. The Gospels are about future, right? We know this somewhere, I think. Did you study this? Was this a question somewhere? Newness, creativity, life, these are key words. And it just amazes me how we've become old, historical, hysterical, divisive. Jesus, in a sense, now I would not ask this of you because you're a much more enlightened group, but I would always ask lots of people, was Jesus Catholic? And of course, people will say, oh, well, Jesus wasn't Catholic, but his mother. No, what is it? Jesus was Catholic, but his mother was Jewish. That's right. Catholicos, right? A consciousness of the whole. There is something that breaks through in Jesus, a new spirit of wholeness, a new consciousness of the whole. So I think his actions of restoring to health and healing lepers and forgiveness and reconciliation, I think what we see in Jesus is a consciousness of community, a consciousness that this is not it, that we are called into something more. If we, in a sense, live with that God-centered consciousness within us. So, you know, even Jesus' own words, I have come that you might have life and have it to the full. So I think this Christian message is about healthy life for the whole of the cosmos. And with that life, there is death. I want to say that culturally, we have made death an opposite of life, you know, as if these things are in opposition. But if we look at evolution, just the natural process of evolution, there have been millions of species that have gone extinct, that have died, that have even suffered and died, and those deaths have made possible the conditions for a new type of life form to emerge. There is a costliness to life. That's what we're saying here. And in Jesus, we see that costliness for life in his own death. You know, unless I go, he says, the Spirit cannot come. That it's not about him. It is about God, right? It is about this movement into Omega, that fullness of life in life itself. So his death is sort of this release into wholeness, this movement into a new relatedness with God now in the cosmos. We are people of the resurrection, although I wonder about that sometimes. I said we're very good on incarnation, but then so is everyone else. You don't have to be Catholic or Christian to like Christmas. Everyone loves babies and everyone loves gifts, right? But you come to Easter, and really we just don't have that same enthusiasm. You know, we have sort of like the Lord is risen. Alleluia, alleluia, right? That's very nice. I like your lilies, you know. Where'd you get your lilies? Where'd you get the ham? It just amazes me that people of the resurrection should be the freest, most liberated, most conscious, most future-oriented people. We should, in a sense, have a new sense of self that is standing on the horizon of a new world. Because I think that's what resurrection speaks to us about. And I think God continues to reveal God's self as we struggle. And I think the whole process, quite honestly, moving beyond SCOTUS through Teilhard, it is a trinitizing process. As we are drawn to this Omega, as we are drawn to God, we also not are only distinguished, we also have a resistance to God's plan. And as we, in a sense, come to a new higher form of consciousness, we struggle within ourselves, we struggle among ourselves, we are called to be moving to new levels of consciousness and compassion. So Teilhard's famous line, I think, is really important to us. We cannot be saved. We cannot find wholeness except in and through this universe as a continuation of the universe. And that means if Christogenesis is the reality of this evolutionary creation, that at some point we are going to have to detribalize religions. We are going to be called into a new level of convergence, of harnessing, you might say, the best of what we are in terms of our spiritual energies. Because Teilhard did not think that the Christ belonged only to Catholics. He thought that the Christ is the whole. And Jesus, in a sense, is, in a sense, the way. He is that truth, but that puts Christians on the edge of evolution. In other words, we're not ontologically distinct from others. We are to be the prime evolvers. That's how he saw Christian life in an evolutionary universe. He spoke of the church as a new phylum, not as the great exemption to the whole, but as the new species in which the whole would find, might say, renewed life. So in this respect, I think, now I have more slides, but I think it's 5 o'clock, so you want me to keep going? You want me to stop? I'll just say this. Christianity for Teilhard, beyond SCOTUS, is a religion of evolution. We do not think in these terms yet, although, you know, slowly, because evolution happens slowly. So I'm thinking maybe another billion years we might get this. In other words, what we are about is future. Jesus, in a sense, alludes to this in his own way, right? New wine, new wineskins. Don't stick with the dead, you'll be dead, right? Life happens on the cusp of the new that is breaking in. So we need a consciousness of being in evolution. And if I may put this challenge out in a school of theology, this is where I think we have work to do. Not so much in honing our theological ideas, but in gaining traction in the cosmos we actually live in. Because Teilhard said, before we thought we go to God by abandoning everything, now we realize it's only in and through the earth that we really enter into that fullness of life. Does sin exist? Absolutely. Sin is, in a sense, living in that exile of unrelatedness. The rejection of the call to community, or you might say the resistance to whole making. I do not want to be whole, nor do I want to be part of a whole. But I do think, if I could just put this in here, bringing together our new cosmology with our theology is not enough to just keep it on the level of the intellectual I understand now. We need a type of interior, what we call involution. We need a new level of consciousness. And I think that is part of being an evolution, that we need to focus our mind for life. Somehow, you know, our ancient desert fathers and mothers, you know, they all went to the desert. Discipline. We were disciplined in the old days. Today, we sort of have what I might call junk food brains, you know. We're in an information overloaded era where everything is coming at us. And we don't know anymore what's really good to hold on to and what to let go of. So what are our new disciplines? To focus our mind for life. And we do know from the point of neuroscience, here's good news. Here's part of the good news. The brain changes. The brain can change, new neurons can grow, and it doesn't matter how old you are. So we need to think through this God-empowered, this Omega-powered evolution toward a new level of life that is more just and unified. You know, the whole thing, in some ways, and I think most of spirituality, if not all of it, does come down to consciousness. And there's a famous saying, when the level of our awareness changes, we start attracting a new reality. And so it is about an openness to shifts in consciousness that shift how we see the world. Teilhard even thought our method of worship and our methods of action are too old. They don't empower us to be part of something that is longing to rise up at the heart of this evolutionary cosmos. So the question really is not about God or what God is doing. God is love. And that absolute love is incarnating all along the way. Jesus is, you might say, the consciousness of God, that deeply entangled one. But I think also we know that God is the future. Why we fear the future always just amazes me, since that future is our empowering present. So we are today, you know, beyond the world of Bonaventure and Scotus, and yet their insights on cosmic Christology, their insights on a God of immense love who continues to share that love, to empower us, now helps us realize we are on the cusp of a process of birthing the Christ, that there is no whole other than the wholeness that emerges in and through our lives. The more we know that wholeness of God in the center of our lives, we will help make whole that God at the heart of life. And that, for all practical purposes, is giving birth to God. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of Catholic Theological Union. For additional videos and podcasts, or to learn more, please visit www.ctu.edu or visit learn.ctu.edu.